This is Jeff Whitley, and I'm speaking from my home in Lubbock, Texas. The date is 23 May 2005. I'm interviewing via phone Mr. Tony Romero as he talks to me from his home in Clovis, New Mexico. A former Marine and Vietnam combat veteran, Mr. Romero knew First Lieutenant Lee Herron as their company participated in Operation Dewey Canyon in February 1969. Mr. Romero, thank you for talking with me today and for agreeing to share your experiences on audio tape.
Thank you, sir.
And I guess to begin with, Tony, if you don't mind me calling you Tony.
No, sir.
Tell me about where you were born where and when.
I was born here in Clovis in February 24th, 1949.
Wow. So this
I didn't think I would speak 20 years old.
Right. Right.
It was 2 days before my birthday.
Yes.
Yeah, it was scary.
Did you go to Clovis High School?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
And tell me a little bit about your growing up there in Clovis.
Well, it was a good. I had a good childhood, even though my dad died when I was 7 years old, died of a heart attack. Grew up with my mom. My mom never remarried. I had older brothers and cousins and uncles and a pretty good growing up. You know, I was a Social Security baby growing up. My dad worked for the same company for I think 16 years before he died.
Where was that?
He worked for El Rancho Milling Company here in Clovis. I didn't know what was going to happen to us. He died Christmas Day. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty rough, you know, during the holidays. And it always was, you know, after that. But the family was, we had a lot of support. And like I said, I had older brothers and uncles and cousins, and everybody lived pretty close together. And I started boxing when I was 13.
Started boxing, you said?
Yes. In junior high, I was in a tumbling team, and growing up, you know, through elementary and junior high, and then I started boxing. Never played basketball or baseball or stuff like that, but I enjoyed boxing. By the time I finished with my amateur career, I had 96 wins, 14 losses, and went to the national tournament twice. Could have gone three times, but I only went twice.
Do you have any KOs?
A lot of them, yeah. I was a pretty good puncher. I wasn't a very good boxer, but I was a real good puncher. And had a great, great time. We fought in Amarillo, Lubbock, all over West Texas. Went to California a few times, fought in Milwaukee, Salt Lake City, Denver, Albuquerque, Roswell, all over the country. You know, we had a great team, you know, and it was basically a team like the one we had in Vietnam, you know. Everybody worked together, and we had a mission, and our mission in the boxing team was to win, our mission in Vietnam was to get all our brothers, bring them home alive, you know, if we could, you know.
Yes, sir.
So my upbringing helped me a lot in the Marine Corps.
Yeah, because you had a close.
I had a lot of, yes.
Now, did you, when did you, when was your boxing career over?
When we left Vietnam and went to Okinawa as a unit, I started boxing with I made the 3rd Marine Division boxing team there in Camp Swab, Okinawa. That was the 3rd Marine Division was out of Okinawa, the 3rd Marine Division boxing team, and I made the team. In fact, I was the captain of the team there before. And then we were getting ready to go to Japan to fight in Japan. And I got malaria real bad.
Oh, no.
Again in Okinawa. And I wound up going to Japan, get air-vac to Japan while the team was boxing up there. I was in the hospital in Japan.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I had malaria once in Vietnam. The symptoms of malaria, and I was in a hospital ship there for about 3 weeks till I got better, you know. And most of it was I slept and ate pretty good on that hospital ship.
Was that,
and,
Tony, was that after after February 22nd?
I think it was, I guess it was after February 2nd, yeah.
Or 22nd?
Yes,
okay.
I think it was after February 22nd,
okay.
Yeah.
So you graduated high school, then you...
No, sir, what happened was the national tournament was in, that year was in Salt Lake City, Utah in 1968. It was in February, and I was determined. I had just turned 18 at the national tournament, and on the 24th I was at the national tournament up there, and I was determined to, I wasn't very good in school, so I quit school, and right before then,
okay.
And after the national tournament, I was going to go to California and turn professional. And as soon as we got back from Salt Lake City, about the 27th or the 28th, I already had a death notice at the house. Mm. So I had, I think I had... like 20 days before I had to appear up there in Amarillo.
Tell me about that day when you came home, and if you remember, and got that letter.
Well, I didn't know much about Vietnam. I wasn't, you know, the war wasn't even on my radar, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't thinking about it, and I ate boxing, slept it, drank it, everything was boxing, you know. And I was hoping I'd do good at the national tournament, and I did pretty good. The guy that beat me won the tournament that year. So I says I just turned 18. I said I wanna go and see what I can do, you know. Come home and my letter's at the house, you know. So I knew I was going to go in the Marine Corps. At least I was going to try to change over to the Marine Corps from the Army. And when I went up there, I asked them if I could join the Marine Corps, and they said yeah, for the same 2-year enlistment as the Army. And me and a guy from Lubbock went together to San Diego from Amarillo.
Really?
I'm trying to remember his name now. But I'll have to think about it. I was trying to think about it yesterday.
Okay.
And he lives there in Amarillo, and I've always tried to get a hold of him when I've been up there looking in the phone book, but I've never been able to. He was a pretty sharp guy. In fact, he was the one of the top guys in the. I think he was the guy that won the Marine Blues at the end of our boot camp. The best recruit of our platoon 188. And I'll remember his name in a little bit. But he's from Lubbock, Texas, and we were good friends. But after boot camp, he went one way and we went the other. And I thought, you know, in Vietnam, I've seen a few guys that went to boot camp with me, but I never seen him. And I can picture him right now. You know, I can see him right now, but I can't.
Is he a big guy?
He was taller than me. He was, no, he wasn't real big. I'd say he was like maybe 5'7", 5'6", 5'7". Good looking. Sir?
How tall are you, Tony?
I'm 5'5". And, he was the best. He was the best in our platoon, and he was, he won the Driss Blues, you know. The top guy is the one that wins the Driss Blues at the end of the boot camp. And we graduated on the 4th of July as we graduated from boot camp. So that's pretty special to me, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you didn't think much about Vietnam, and you got the letter. And why did you want to go into the Marine Corps versus the Army?
One of my older brothers was in the Marine Corps doing Korea. And, you know, we always heard as kids that the Marines were the best unit and the toughest, you know. And when we played the Army, you know, in our yards, I was always the Marine, you know. And my mom?
Your brother.
Oh, his name was Seferino.
Okay. Can you spell it?
Rose, how do you spell Seferino? S-E-F-E-R. Either E-N-O or I-N-O. I-N-O? Yeah. She says it's I-N-O.
And is he still living?
No, he was killed in 1955.
And how many brothers did? How many siblings did you have, Tony?
I had 7 brothers and 1 sister.
How many are still living?
I think I've got 5 now. Yeah, 5. 5 brothers and 1 sister.
So tell me about you when you enlisted in the Marine Corps, and if you want to share a little bit about...
In Amarillo?
Yes, sir, and then the events, boot camp and everything, kind of leading up to when you were deployed.
Oh, well, in Amarillo, I just asked them. I said, I want to, is it possible for me to join the Marine Corps? And they said, yeah, you know. we went, and they flew us to San Diego, picked us up at the airport, and took us by way of Jeep to Camp Pendleton, to MCRD there at Camp Pendleton, the Marine Corps Recruiting Depot. and they started on us, you know. It was the hardest thing that I've ever done, but physically, I didn't have no problems. In fact, during our running, when we were running, they tell me to go back and pick up stragglers, you know, because I was in great physical condition. And I've never had a problem saying yes sir and no sir and obeying orders. So I got in trouble a week before graduation. It's the only time I ever got in trouble up there with my drill instructor. Me and a buddy of mine from Denver were talking on the chow line. And after we finished supper that night, we were back cleaning our weapons. And he called us in to his duty hut, you know, and he told us, 1 week. You guys got 1 week left, and you messed up, you know. And he was sitting down, and this drill instructor was black. I can't remember his name now, and he was about 7 foot tall, I guess. He was real tall, and he put his foot on my chest and swung me across that duty hut. I hit against the wall, and then my buddy did the same thing to my buddy, and that was it. You know, that was the only time I ever got in trouble, and you can't leave boot camp without getting some kind of trouble, you know, but I enjoyed it. I appreciate discipline, especially if I'm going to be in some kind of harm's way. I want to learn and be taught by people that did it before I did, you know.
Did you think about what you're in for? I mean,
well, they told us every day. They told us in boot camp every day that 80% of us wouldn't come back, you know.
Really?
You're going to die, you know. And I said to myself, well, I'm going to make sure I don't die, you know, because it was drilled into us every day that, when, you know, so many guys were getting killed that, if it was a scare tactic that they used to keep us, motivated and our eyes and ears open, you know.
Yes, sir.
I didn't even think about getting, screwing up and getting recycled and have to go through it all over again, you know? So, because a lot of guys did, you know, they either got, there's a lot of guys that, I think when our platoon 188 started with about 110 guys. And I bet you at the end, of the original 110, I bet you there wasn't 30 of us that went through the whole thing together, because they recycled guys, and a lot of them got kicked out of the Marine Corps for either physical or mental problems, you know. So we went through about 30, maybe 35 of us went through the whole thing together, you know. And I've seen some of them guys in Vietnam, yeah. Excuse me.
Well, take me out of boot camp and when you were assigned to your unit.
Well, we graduated from boot camp and we got our MOS. Mine was Grunt was an 0311, and mine was an 0341, which is machine guns, mortars, machine guns, and rocket launchers. That's what I, right after boot camp, I went to I think it was ITR. I think after boot camp, and that's what I went to school for: mortars, machine guns, and rocket launchers. How to use them, you know. And then I don't remember if it was ITR or BITS, which was basic infantry training. I'm thinking basic infantry training was the last school that we went through right before we went to Vietnam. And that was more or less, it was all about Vietnam, kind of, you know, the land, the jungles, and trying to teach us about what to expect, you know. And we went through that school, and
did it talk to you about the women?
Yeah, the women, they said if we got the black, what do you call it? I can't remember what it was called now. We wouldn't come back. They would send us to an island, some kind of a disease. If it's a black, black something, I can't remember what it was, but they said if you get that, you will not come back to the United States. They will drop you off in an island, and you will die there.
Are they talking about venereal disease?
Yeah, yes, sir. Some kind of black something. I can't even remember what it was now, but yeah. You know, and, but in Vietnam, we never went anywhere, you know. We'd go back to the rear, back to the rock pile, you know, every, you know, about 40, 45 days, we'd go back for 3 days, and it was just a base like, you ever watch the movie MASH?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, it's basically a camp like that MASH unit is in. In fact, it reminds me a lot of it because we were surrounded by mountains all the way around us, and the camp was inside, you know, inside the mountain area. And MASH reminds me a lot of the rock pile.
Is that where the death of the dead and wounded came back to that Tervandagriff?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you would come back from the field every 45 days or so?
Yeah, around that time. There was a couple of times that they, instead of going to the rock pile, they flew us to a place called Qua Viet. It was on the South China Sea, so we could bathe in the sea to get rid of a jungle rot, you know, and you know, a lot of them guys were, you know, we'd be in them jungles and you get cut up with the leaves, you know, your arms would get cut and your necks would get cut and your feet would start kind of rotting off and stuff with all that, I don't know if it was the moisture or and the heat mixed together or what, but a lot of guys would have problems with their feet and stuff and their fingers.
What was that like? Was it like athlete's foot or jock itch or something?
Yeah, something like that. So we went to Qua Viet, I think twice we went up there and spent like 3 days up there,
okay.
You know, and just enjoying the sun. And they had security out there for us, you know. It was like a resort, an R&R type, in-country R&R outfit to where, and we'd be by ourselves, you know. They'd bring in a helicopter would bring in a pallet of a beer and food for us and stuff, you know. And we'd party for 3 days, you know, and then we'd head back out, you know.
Tell me more about that Qua Viet.
Qua Viet?
Yeah, tell me more about, what about the, I guess the water was nice and the beach was nice?
Oh, yeah, it was white beach and beautiful waters and we'd swim and just party, you know, just watch movies at night and eat good and drink and we'd receive packages. You know, they'd send all our mail up there and just enjoy ourselves for a few days.
Y'all watch the movies?
Yes, sir. They put up a sheet, a white bed sheet, and hook up a generator and a machine to watch movies, you know, outside, you know. And we'd watch movies, you know, all night, you know.
Were these old movies, or were these movies that were coming out in the 60s?
They were current movies.
Yeah,
they were current.
Well, you remember any of them?
No, sir, I don't. I sure don't know. It's been a long time.
I hadn't
thought about it in a long time.
Tell me what kind of, you're a rock and roller, I know. Tell me what kind of music you listened to. What were your favorite tunes back then?
The Stones and Rolling, the early Stones and my favorite back then was probably the Supremes, you know, was my favorite group, you know, rock and roll. Buddy Holly, you know.
Did you listen to Buddy Holly?
Yes, sir. Uh-huh. Okay. Oh, yeah. I grew up, have you ever heard of the Norman Petty Studio?
Yes, sir.
Here in Clovis?
Yes, sir.
Well, I grew up a block and a half from there. And as kids, you know, in the summertime, they'd be recording at the studio, and then Mr. Petty had a big backyard, and they'd be cooking out and partying back there, you know. I guess they're having jam sessions or recording sessions and stuff, and we go back there and listen to them and peep through the fence, you know, and they'd be back there, you know, they were from here in Clovis. They made a couple of top tens, I think. I can't remember their names right now. And, you know, there was a lot of groups that recorded here in Clovis back then. Buddy Holly recorded a lot of his songs here in Clovis.
Joe Ely, was he one of them?
Who?
Joe Ely.
I can't remember the names. I remember Buddy Holly and what's the name of that group here in town? Rose, what's the name of that group here in town that... Did they still play some? The Fireballs, remember the Fireballs?
Yeah.
Yeah, they used to record there at Norman Petty there by the house. And we'd listen to them guys and, you know, we were just, you know, 14, 15, 16-year-old kids, you know, right there in the neighborhood, you know. And it was pretty neat, you know. Because they'd have jam sessions outside, and then we could hear them recording from the inside, you know. And it was a lot of fun. I went through it a couple of years ago. I toured the studios again. They opened it up in the summer for people to tour it, you know. And that's when I first, you know, that's when I knew about Buddy Holly back then. And then when I seen Lieutenant Herring up there, you know, when he told me Lubbock, Texas, I Buddy Holly, Lubbock, Texas, and then the glasses, you know, because up in Nam, you know, you could, in the Marine Corps or in the military, you pick up nicknames pretty easy. I had a buddy in Nam that called me Torito.
Polito?
Polito means baby bull.
Yeah, Polito.
Yeah, so that's what all them guys used to call me up there, Polito.
Tony, who are your idol boxers?
Back then?
Yeah, who'd you idolize growing up?
my idol has always been Rocky Marciano, because he was never beaten, and Ray Robinson, you know.
Oh yeah.
You know.
Any Latinos that you liked?
Back then, no, there wasn't too many back then that I really, you know, there was.
Did you ever see Chavez fight?
No, I have never seen him live, but you're talking about back, how far back then you're talking about?
Oh, I'm talking about in the 80s.
In the 80s, Arguello, from South America, he was one of my idols, and from Mexico I can't remember his name now. He died in an automobile accident. He was a great, great fighter. I can't remember his name offhand now.
What was your style?
Mine was, but like Rocky, you know, like
Brawler?
Joe Frazier. Joe Frazier was a big idol of mine back in the 80s. A puncher, you know. I would say Joe Frazier was the Raging Bull. What was his name? I can't remember his name
Marciano.
Now.
Marciano.
No.
I'm sorry.
Jake LaMotta.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jake LaMotta. Because that was my style of fighting, you know.
Well, you...
A puncher.
You weren't afraid of a fight, were you?
Sir?
You
were. Oh, I loved it. I loved the fight. And
didn't matter how big a guy
most
was.
Oh no, they weren't going to be too. I had problems with boxers that were a little taller than me. Mm-hmm. But if not, I just push them and push them, push, move forward, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was fighting on television in Los Angeles one time, and I didn't see the film till later, you know. And the guy says, he says, this Tony Romero's only got one gear, and that's forward. But my first fight in California when I went up there to turn pro was at the Olympic Auditorium as a professional. And it was, I still remember it because, it was my first fight. And I was in the dressing room at the old Olympic Auditorium, and... his son is an announcer now. I can't remember his name now. And I'm trying to think, and I just go blank. I'll remember after a while. Anyway, let's get back.
Yes, let's go back
to the first day that I got to Vietnam.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that day.
Oh yeah, tell me about
We flew in. Commercial Airlines to Vietnam. We went from Los Angeles from El Toro in California to Hawaii. From Hawaii we went to Vietnam. We weren't in Hawaii for very long, and we got another flight, or they refueled, and we went to Vietnam. When we were getting ready to land in Vietnam, there was stewardess on the flight. You know, just like a regular commercial airlines. And they told us, we'll be back to pick you up. You know, in a year. And getting off that plane, I remember that I could smell the fuel, the diesel fuel or the plane fuel or whatever, and it was like a rat race at that airport in Da Nang. And there was a buddy of mine that we were real close in bits before we went to Vietnam, and he was on his second going on his second tour to Vietnam. He was from Florida. His name was Fred. What was his name? I can't remember. Pettigrew. Fred Pettigrew. And he was a PFC just like I was. He lost all his rank when he came back to the, he was an E5 and lost all his rank when he came back and got in some problems, some trouble with the Marine Corps and stuff and couldn't adjust.
Yes, sir.
So he went on his second tour. He was a machine gunner. So, when we landed in Da Nang, he says, let's hook up with the 9th Marines. And I said, why 9th Marines? He says, because they're the baddest FMs in Vietnam. So I says, okay. I know what the hell I was getting into. So we went up there and he talked to some people and stuff. And I got in with Alpha Company 19, and he gets in with Delta 19. And he was a PFC, and I was a PFC. So they loaded us up on trucks, and they took us up. They took me and the people that were wondering to Alpha, and the other Bravo Charlie and Delta takes us up to the rock pile. To the base there, and they put him with Delta Company, and they put me with Alpha Company, and we got to see each other whenever we ran a battalion size operation. You know, we all hooked up there, and we got a chance to talk.
Was everyone. Was Fred Hispanic?
No, sir. He was Anglo.
Okay.
And he was crazy. Remember the movie Smokey and the Bandit?
Of course.
Remember the truck driver, Burt Reynolds' buddy?
Reed.
Jerry Reed,
yeah.
He looked like him and talked like him. He was from Florida, so he had that accent, and he was just crazy. You know, and he was a good guy. We got together every time we were running operations, you know, together. You know, we'd always hook up and got a chance to talk. But when I got to the Alpha Company, Lieutenant Davis, which was second platoon commander. At that time, looked at me and says, you're going to be my radio man. And I said, yes, sir. And I think I have had maybe 2 or 3 days training in radio, you know. But you know, you learn it, you know.
Yeah, but your specialty was...
Sir?
Your specialty was in rockets and grenade launchers. And
Yeah. But he wanted. He said, "You're going to be my radio man, and a second platoon radio man." And I said, "Yes, sir." So I was his radio man there for I don't know a couple of months, I guess, and then the gunnery sergeant told me. I guess he talked to Lieutenant Davis and told me, he says, I got a mission for you. I need a mailman, combat mailman. And I want you want to do it? I said, well, I guess, you know, if that's what you want me to do. He says, I want you to go to the rock pile, to Vandalgriff, and go in and get IDs taken, picture taken, ID, and you'll be delivering the mail, you know. So that's That's what I did, you know. And
how long did you do that, Tony?
I did that for I don't know a month or so. I didn't do it for very long because the guy started saying, "Here comes slack."
Yeah, you didn't like
because
that.
Because I was back in the rear for about, you know, 2, 3, 4 days, and if they were having contact, you know, they wouldn't deliver mail or supplies, you know, then I'd have to check at the LZ when there was taking them supplies so I can take their mail out to them, you know, and I didn't only, sir.
I was just going to say, that's completely, from what I've heard you say, completely opposite your character. Is to
yeah, well, I wanted to do what I was trained to do, you know, but the gunny asked me, and I volunteered, and I was bad at volunteering. Anyway, I go back and take them their mail, and if there wasn't any contact, you know, I'd stay over the night. And catch another chopper on the way out the next day, you know, that were delivering supplies and ammo and stuff. I'd hitch right back, you know, if they weren't in a hot LZ or someplace, you know. And if they wanted certain things done back in the rear, packages sent for going by so-and-so and send it to so-and-so and I do stuff like that, you know. Another thing that I did was I delivered a lot of drugs to them guys out there because that's what they wanted, you know. I was at their beck and call, more or less, you know. And
So, when you brought the drugs in,
sir.
When you, I'm sorry, you can't hear me very well. When you, so you brought drugs to, are these a lot of enlisted men?
What's that again?
Were these enlisted men you were taking drugs
to? Yes, sir. Yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah, I wasn't with them, so the least I can do is. Get them what they wanted, you know.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And even the medics, the Navy medics that we had, you know, they'd give them guys whatever they wanted, you know.
You bet.
You know, it was no problem getting anything back at the rock pile. Or a lot of times we'd go to, you know, villages and we could, you know, we'd have friendlies, you know, go and give us, sell us, you know, narcotics, you know. It was, you know, I never remember anybody getting in trouble because it wasn't like you could be busted and thrown in jail, you know.
Right.
It was as long as you did your job, you know. And it was a bad deal because all it brought me after I came back was a lot of pain and suffering.
Yes, sir.
You know, and a year in the penitentiary, you know, when I came back, you know,
yes, sir.
15 years ago, you know, but that's the way it was, you know.
Yes, sir.
That's the way it was, you know. So finally, but after, I don't know how long I was carrying the mail, but I finally told the gunny, I says, you need to get somebody else to do this because I want to, here comes slack. When I got off that helicopter and they had a load of mail on me and stuff, and they say, here comes slack, you know. He's up there sleeping in the tent and eating hot food and I'd even take him bottles of whiskey back there, you know, and you know, and drugs. And finally, I told the gunny, I says, get somebody else. You know, I wanna be a member of the company. You know, so he did that, and I got in with 60 millimeter mortars, and my first job was a ammo humper, carried ammo on my back, and then I was an A gunner, and then I was a gunner, and then I was a squad leader, and then I was a section leader, and then I was an acting platoon sergeant. I went all the way to the top.
You sure did.
Before we left Vietnam.
So were you, you were Davis's sergeant then?
No. When I went into weapons, I was in 4th platoon.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Weapons was 4th platoon. You had 1st, 2nd, and 3rd platoon, and then weapons platoon was 4th platoon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who was your commanding officer?
At that time, well, I can't remember. I can see his face, but I can't remember his name before we got Lieutenant Fox, and then he made captain with us, because I think we got him as a lieutenant when we got him at Alpha, and then he made captain with us.
Did he survive?
Sir?
Was he killed?
No, I'm talking about Colonel Fox.
Oh, well, I was talking about this, the man you could...
No, he rotated.
Okay.
The captain that was, I think it was, yeah, he was the captain that we had before we got Lieutenant Fox. Yeah, I think, I'm pretty sure he rotated.
Okay.
When we got Lieutenant Fox.
So, you, a couple of months you said that you were... a radio man, and
mm-hmm.
You were back in the element for a couple more months after that, by delivering mail?
Yes, combat, what they call the combat mailman.
Okay. How long did it take you to go from, to get to be a sergeant from,
I was actually a E4, a corporal.
Okay.
But I was an acting platoon sergeant, and it's on my, I got sergeant on my discharge, on my papers, but I was just an acting platoon sergeant, is what they called it, you know. But on my papers that I got from my records, it says sergeant on it, but I was discharged as when I got discharged in the Marine Corps, I was a corporal, but it was just an acting. I never got the pay grade as a sergeant.
Is there anything during that time when you were carrying the mail that any event or something that happened that you know, obviously there were probably dead and wounded coming in. I mean, how did you feel about that whenever you were pretty much back in the back safe?
I didn't feel right. You know, I feel like I was cheating. You know, I didn't go to Vietnam to be a mailman. You know, I wanted to be out with my troops and my buddies. You know, and. Because while I was when I was a radio man for Lieutenant Davis, I was with 2nd Platoon, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that's the platoon that the Lieutenant Herring took over when the other officer got hit.
Is See, if you, tell me about the first time you engaged in combat as a gunner. You're a mortar, but
I had a good platoon sergeant in weapons platoon. His name was Sergeant Kelly. I think it was from South Carolina, and he was a Korean war veteran. I think he was on his second tour in Vietnam, and he was a damn good teacher, you know, as far as mortars were concerned, you know. And he taught us well, you know. And when we were on top on an LZ someplace, or where we weren't getting any contact, we'd be working every day, working on our guns, you know, elevations, deflections, this, that, you know, running fire missions without not using ammo, but setting up our guns. And getting our directions and everything together, you know, and whenever we had a fire, you know, because we were right there with the first, second, and third platoon, you know, we were the 60 millimeter mortars are pretty short tubes, you know, their range isn't very far. And we were right there with them guys. The only problems we had a lot of times were that we couldn't fire was if we had a lot of overhead, like close to us, you know, right directly above us, but you couldn't fire. In fact, there was one time. Well, getting back to the first time that we had contact
yes, sir.
With the enemy.
Yes, sir.
Everybody knew their job. It was just like 1, 2, 3, you know. Everybody did what they had to do and everything worked out well. I mean, I got wounded and we had other guys that got wounded at different times. You know, even with, you know, because we were just a little bit behind first, second, and third platoon. They were ahead of us, and we were always just a little ways in back of them, you know.
Give me a timeline about when this first engagement happened for you. And
I can't remember dates, sir.
Well, I mean, were you you were in probably maybe 6 months? I don't know.
Probably no.
What time?
No. I had a see. I was a mailman. I was a when we seen combat when I was a radio man. You know, we seen combat there. You know. When I was with 2nd Platoon, when I was Lieutenant Davis's radio man.
Right.
And I was right there with him, you know. I was his radio man. I was right there with him, you know.
What's that like?
Yeah, it's pretty scary because you gotta be right on his toes, you know, because he needs you right there and you need a lot of times he'll tell you call so and so and I want to get with so and so and you got to know what you're doing and be right. You're his shadow more or less, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so
or he's your shadow. Yeah.
Stuff was hitting all around you then, I guess.
Yes, sir.
Now tell me about that first wound.
When I got hit?
Yes, sir, when you got hit.
Well, we were, it was in, what was it, March, did I say? I think, yeah, it was March 12th, I think. I can't remember, 10th or 12th, I can't remember. Anyway, we'd been on this hill for a few days, and it'd been raining. It was been raining day and night, and I was on radio watch, and I looked up, and I seen some muzzle flashes, you know, 4 or 5 muzzle flashes, and I was gonna call it in when they hit us, you know, when they hit our area that we were at. And killed a couple of guys. They got a direct hit, and one guy had a week left before he was going to be fly back to the rear to leave the country. And I got wounded, and several of the guys got wounded. I think there was 2 guys that got killed that morning, and it was right before daybreak. My first reaction when I got hit, I couldn't feel my right hand. I got shrapnel in my fingers in my right hand, and I got a slug in my leg right above the knee, and it didn't hit a bone. It just went through the meat, you know, in my thigh.
Did it go all the way through?
No, it didn't go all the way through. And my first reaction was that there was nothing I could do. My first reaction was jump in my foxhole. I jumped in my foxhole, and it was full of water and mud, because it had been raining for 2 or 3 days, you know, day and night. And I couldn't feel my leg, and I couldn't feel my hand. My first reaction was I had lost my leg and my hand, because it was still pitch dark. So 4 or 5 minutes later, the sun is coming out, and I could see that I was still whole, you know. And we didn't fire. Nobody fired, because they didn't get a good hit on us. They didn't know where, you know, they just got the side of that hill where we were at. So as soon as daybreak broke, we called in some jets and bombed that hill where we got fired from. But we got hit with RPG rockets that morning.
Now, Tony, that was March, and
sir,
I'm sorry, you're having a tough time hearing me. That was March. You thought March.
March 18th. March 12th, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, if you would, I'd like you to go back and tell me, you know, when you met Lieutenant Heron. Kind of tell me about that scene whenever you first met him, and any other recollections you have of conversations you had with Lee?
Well, I can't remember the day that he came in, and I remember, you know, we'd ask, you know, we'd check and see who came in, because we were getting a lot of reinforcements, you know, we were losing guys, and we were getting new guys in pretty regular. And when he got there, I don't remember who he replaced, but somebody said had a lieutenant from Texas, you know. And because that's the first thing you'd ask when somebody came in, where are you from, you know.
Uh-huh.
And somebody said he's from West Texas, someplace in Lubbock, you know. And I says, Lubbock? Hell, he's just 100 miles from Clovis, you know. So I got a chance to meet him one day, and I told him, you know, where I was from, and we talked for a while, and you know, just, you know, introducing you know, I went and introduced myself to him and told him where I was from, and we talked for a little bit, and just, you know, just crap. He was a interpreter, wasn't he?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, he was an interpreter, with a Vietnamese interpreter, and we talked for a little bit, and, you know, I can't remember what platoon. Did he go with, was he a second platoon? No, he wasn't second platoon commander. Was he, I can't remember if he was first or third platoon commander when he first got there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I know Lieutenant Davis moved up to XO, I think, and somebody else took over second platoon. I don't know if it was him or somebody else.
I think it was, I think he did, in fact, take over second platoon.
Yeah, yeah, because Lieutenant Davis moved up to XO because our other black lieutenant, I can't remember his name offhand now, Shepherd, Lieutenant Shepherd, mm-hmm. I think he rotated. And I think maybe that's when Lieutenant Herring came in, when Lieutenant Shepherd rotated back.
So what did he look like? Can you tell me a little bit about him, what he looked like, and kind of how he carried himself?
Well, you know, as soon as I heard who he was and where he was from and his glasses and stuff, that's the first thing that came into my mind was Buddy Holly, you know. You know, so that's what I called him, and because everybody had nicknames. The guys from California all had nicknames. I had a buddy from Oklahoma. His name was Bill Honeycutt, and we all called him Wild Bill Honeycutt. And I haven't talked to him in a few years. I talked to him. We kept up for a long time. And I got buddies from, I don't know if Oscar Balboa, I can't remember what, he was with weapons, but I can't remember if he was a machine gunner, but I don't remember if he was, Lieutenant Herring's, on his team or not. And then I got another buddy from Arizona that I talked to pretty regular, John Nolan. He was a M79 man, and I don't know if he was with on second platoon with Lieutenant Herring or not. I can't remember. I talked to John a couple of weeks ago. We talk a lot. John Nolan.
You know what
an M79 is?
That sounds like a very big something. Mortar?
No, sir. It's real small. It's like a little shotgun.
Is that right?
Yeah. It fired a little, the shell is maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 inches long, and it's 40, I think it's a 40 millimeter round. It's pretty, like a big, big bullet, you know? And it fired in an arc, not straight. It would arc. It was like a little shotgun, like a shot-off shotgun.
Okay.
Yeah. And they were like a shotgun, like a breech, mm-hmm. The one that opens up on top.
Sure.
And they would put two shells in it and fire it, and it had an arc to it. So, you know, you had a John. You know, most of them guys that fired them things, they were pretty good at it. You know, they were pretty accurate. But you know, we talked all the time because you know we were all in the same. area, you know, we traveled together set up camp together. And
Was he kind of quiet, or was he?
He was quiet to an extent, you know. But he's a good natured guy, and he talked to you, and he was intelligent, you know, highly intelligent. He acted like an officer, you know, smart and knew what he was doing, and learning every day, you know, how to survive, you know. But he was highly intelligent. I guess because we used to pick up prisoners every once in a while, you know. Weapons platoon, which was my platoon, would guard them, you know, till they got transported, you know. I guess he was a guy that would communicate with them, you know.
Okay.
Because we didn't carry mountain yards around like a lot of troops did, you know. Mm-hmm. That would translate, or translators that were Vietnamese. We never carried any of them. I guess because Lieutenant Herring was there, we didn't need them, you know.
Did you hear him speak Vietnamese?
I think I did. I was thinking the other night, and I remember when we had some mountain yards that they gave themselves up, and we held them for a while. It was a family, and I think he was talking to them.
He was talking to a family, Vietnamese family?
Yes, yeah. There was another time I can't remember the date now, but me and Sergeant Kelly were on top of a hill on a flight support base, and it was late in the afternoon, and we'd send teams out during the day to let us know if the enemy was coming toward us at any time, you know. That would be out. They'd be out there, and they would radio in if the enemy was coming toward us or something, you know. And it was late in the afternoon, and they'd come in in the afternoon, and then we'd send in what we call killer teams at night, you know, that would stay out there all night, you know. And this one day, that team from the day was coming in, you know, and me and Sergeant Kelly were sitting down talking, and all of a sudden we heard a bunch of gunfire, and I jumped up and set my motor, my 60 millimeter mortar toward that direction, you know, and as soon as I heard on the radio that our troops were in, I started firing, and I fired maybe 12 rounds of mortar, and we got them, you know, got them. And we had one guy that survived, one NVA soldier that survived, and he was brought in and questioned and air-vac'd back to the rock pile. I received a Navy commendation with a V for Valor for that, because the guys that were coming in, there was about five guys on that unit that were out there that were coming in, and they just met, you know, and they had a little scrimmage, and they were able to make it into our lines. And once I knew that they were inside our lines, I started firing. I fired, I don't know, 8, 10, 12 rounds, you know. And the guys from the other side of the hill, man, they came down and said, man, them guys were were flying all over that, you know, you were blowing up banana trees, and we could see bodies flying, you know. And I never thought anything about it, you know. And after I got out of the Marine Corps, they've been trying to trace me for 6 months, you know, because I was in Vietnam and Okinawa, and then went to Japan to the hospital, and then wound up back in California, and then back to Corpus Christi, to the hospital in Corpus Christi, and then I was transporting prisoners back and forth from California, and then I got out December 5th, 1969 is when I got out of the Marine Corps, and then, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, 6 months later, I finally get a letter at home that they were going to give me a medal, and I went to Lubbock, Texas, to the Marine Corps unit that they had in Lubbock. Do they still have it there?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Did you, the Commandant, for a little while, was John Monfort, our former chancellor at Texas Tech.
Oh, is that right?
I don't know that you saw him, though, when you were there at that time. But
I don't remember. But they presented me with that Navy commendation there in Lubbock. And I don't know. It was, 4, 5, 6 months after I was out of the Corps. And that was pretty neat.
Absolutely. Congratulations.
Sir?
You deserve it. Congratulations, sir.
Thank you.
And then, any other engagements you want to talk about before we talk about February 22nd?
Well, you know, just like in Iraq and all them other places that we're involved in combat, there's accidents that happen, you know?
Yes, sir.
Human nature, I guess, you know, there's accidents. There was a few accidents that I remember that we had that we lost troops, you know. One time we were on top of this LZ and, we had some big 155, 175 artillery. We had an artillery unit there, and they were burning, I can't remember the stuff, powder. They were burning powder off that they weren't, I guess, old powder that they were burning that they didn't use, and a helicopter came in, a big supply helicopter came in, and with the propellers going, it blew the lit powder inside an ammo bunker, and we lost, I think, two guys that day. And a lieutenant got killed that day, you know. But it was like, you know.
Was this before?
I can't remember exactly when it was. Mm-hmm. I think it was before February. I can't remember. But they were called increments. They were bags of powder, and they were burning them, you know, getting rid of them. And a chopper came in, and it blew ashes or the powder in an ammo bunker that we had there, and one of the guns, it completely blew it off the pad where it was at, you know, and blew that gun out, and started the hill on fire. We had to evacuate the hill. If the Vietnamese would have been watching us, they'd still be left in the day, you know, of what happened that day, you know. But, you know, the bad thing is we lost, I think it was three guys that got killed and several wounded, you know. But, you know, stuff happens, you know. We were firing a mission one time. We were in combat, and I was a section leader, and one of my guys was getting ready to double feed the gun, you know. If he would have double fed it, if I wouldn't have caught him, we would have lost some guys. We would have gotten killed, you know. He just got excited, you know, and like to got us killed, you know. But I was right there, and I seen him when he was getting ready to double feed that gun, and I just got him from the back of the shirt and pulled him back. His name was John Lewin, which was from back east someplace.
That was a close call right there.
Yeah. It was, you know, you had to be careful, you know, and you couldn't, that's why we trained every, you know, when we weren't had a mission or we weren't moving, we were always working on our equipment and trying to, getting ready, you know, trying to be ready, you know. There was times when we didn't have any contact with the enemy, and guys would fall asleep at night, you know, and then we get hit and we lose guys, you know, and then for days and days nobody would sleep, you know, but that's all it takes is for somebody to, you know, you get to the point to where you go 2 or 3 weeks with no contact, guys start, you know, falling asleep at night, knowing that there's we ain't seen nothing, there's nothing out there, you know, and then bang, you get hit, you know.
You arrived, you left December 5th, 1969, but you arrived
No, I got discharged December 5th, 1969.
Discharged, yes.
Yes.
But you left before that, and wanted to kind of get to, did the time seem to you, Tony, to go very, very slowly in the jungle, or did things
real slow?
Right. Yeah.
That was a long, long year. You know, it was like, you know, yeah. I mean, the only time we knew that it was Sunday is because we got a different kind of malaria pill on Sundays. On Sunday was a different malaria pill. And we knew it was Sunday, you know.
What was different about it? Was it a different color or something?
Yeah, different color, and they gave us that on Sundays, and we knew, you know, because every day was a working day, you know. And regardless of what day it was, I spent the 4th of July, New Year's, Christmas, my birthday, you know, Memorial Day, Veterans Day, every holiday was another working day, you know. Christmas was pretty sad, you know.
I'm sure.
Yeah. And then another sad part was, some guys were married, you know, and they had kids, and they'd get Dear John letters, you know, you know, there was problems when a guy wasn't, you know, in his mind to fight and protect his buddies, you know, there was, you know, a lot of times it was, they get letters that somebody had died or sickness at home or, you know, there was times when guys got flown out because of a death in, you know, in the family, or a mom, a dad or something, you know, a brother.
Do you remember any of the services at the chapel?
Services?
Yes, sir.
No, sir. Never in the chapel.
Yeah.
We were always in the jungle, you know. The only once in a while on Sundays they might, if we were on a secure LZ, an area, they'd send a priest or somebody out there and give us a little, we'd go to services, you know, and that was about it, you know.
You don't remember? I'm sorry, go ahead.
The only really time that I remember was right before we left Vietnam. They told us that, because we were hearing the scuttlebutt that we were going to be transported out of Vietnam as a unit. We were going to leave as a unit. That was when Nixon, you know, took over and he promised, you know, ending the war, you know. So, because the 9th Marines was the first unit, combat unit with the Marine Corps, we were the first one that was going to leave Vietnam and go to our home base in Okinawa. So that was the word, that we were going to get pulled out, and nobody knew for sure. But one time when we went back to the rock pile, they told us that we were going to get pulled out in a few days, that we were leaving, going to Okinawa. Everybody felt great, you know, because we were going to leave. But they said, we got you one more operation, and you'll take off in the morning. There's a hill that's some guns there, and you guys got to go and knock them out, you know. They were shooting at transport choppers going through there, through that area. So we had to go and see if we could knock them out. Before we left that morning, the next morning, they had clergy. Is it right? Clergy people?
Mm-hmm. Clergy.
What do you call them?
Clergy.
Clergy man, yeah. Of all different denominations. And we had never seen that, experienced that before. You know, they had priests from the Catholic faith and different other clergy people from the different faiths and talking to the different denominations, you know. And we went in, and in fact, we didn't have any. We just talked to them right there at the LZ, at that landing zone where we're going to take off, you know. And we talked to a priest and had a little, did our confessions and stuff, and did the sign of the cross, and he blessed us. They blessed us with holy water, and we boarded the choppers and left, you know.
How many choppers?
Well, I'm thinking, I can't remember because there was, I think, they carried 22 troops in the chopper, and there were, went two troops and I think two pilots and two gunners on a chopper. So that was what, 26 people?
Yes, sir, 26.
And Alpha Company, we flew out first, and Bravo came in behind us, and Charlie and Delta. If I remember right, we landed first and started climbing the hill, and I think it was Charlie Company that came in, and one of their choppers got hit, and we were going up the hill, and I turned back, and I could see that chopper coming straight at us, and it was coming sideways, and it was burning up. It hit the side of the hill and rolled a couple of times and blew up. Well, we got up and we secured the hill. You know, we just looked at it and seen it and kept on doing what we were supposed to do. Got up, secured that hill. We went back to the rear the following day. We had services for them 26 guys that got killed. And that afternoon, we embarked on ships and on a ship and went to Okinawa. You know, and
that same
you know,
day?
It wasn't we weren't celebrating.
No.
You know, it was bad because them guys were gonna go with us, you know. And they didn't make it. I mean when one of them choppers blows up, turns over a couple of times and all that fuel and stuff and just blew up, and there was, I don't think there was nothing left of them guys, you know? And took us 5 days to get to Okinawa. And, hell, most of the time we wouldn't eat because of the fact that the lines were long. You know, there was probably 1,000 troops or more on that ship, you know, and we played cards and just slept, and at night we go up to the top deck and just look out and at the ocean, you know, and thank God that, we survived. There was so many times that we didn't think we would, you know.
Yes, sir, I did.
We get to Okinawa and they made all of us military police. They were having a lot of riots up there in Okinawa. A lot of the people wanted to go back under Japanese. I guess the United States was controlling Okinawa at that time. We finally gave up the island back to the Japanese, I think. Didn't we?
Oh, I'm sorry.
When we went back to Okinawa, they were pretty hostile to Americans up there, to our American troops.
I bet it's coming right out of combat like that, you Marines probably didn't put up with any crap.
No, exactly. Exactly. But we couldn't. We had pistols, mm-hmm, as MPs, you know, but we couldn't, they'd have to point and aim and maybe fire before we could fire. You know, they told us we don't want no problem with these people, you know.
Right.
And, but they would throw rocks at us, they would spit at us. Mm-hmm. You know, the only people that wanted our money was, restaurants and the prostitutes, you know, and the bars, you know, and the bars and stuff, you know, but most people wouldn't have nothing to do with us. So that's what I did. And I was in charge of a MP shift there at Camp Swab in Okinawa. That's what I did. We patrolled we patrolled the whole base there. We took care of the front gate and all the gates and stuff. We patrolled the villages, you know. We did most of the security there around Camp Swap. And then I checked in the head of Third Marine Division boxing team was there out of Okinawa. And got there, and there was a first sergeant that was a coach, and I showed him what I could do, and wound up being under him as the captain of the team. And we're getting ready to go to Okinawa, to Japan, and fight in Japan. And that's when I got malaria. And the last officer that I've seen in Okinawa was Lieutenant Davis. He was the XO, and he went up there to give me a plaque, a one-line plaque. And that's the last time I've seen him. And the last time I talked to him was when I was in Lubbock for the Lieutenant Herring's ceremony up there. One of the lieutenants that was up there. Malone, yeah. Lieutenant Malone says, you served under Davis? I said, yes, sir. I was his radio man there for a long time, for a while, you know. And he says, you want to talk to him? And I said, yes, sir. I'd like to talk to him. And he just picked up his cell phone, and he dialed, and he talked to Lieutenant Davis. In fact, he was in, I think, in Virginia. And he works with us. He works with the CIA now.
Right.
Yeah. Do you know him, Lieutenant Davis?
No, sir. I haven't talked to him yet. But
yeah.
I remember that. You may remember that Malone. I think it was Malone who read his letter.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It freaked me out when me and Oscar Balboa were there. Remember?
Oh yeah.
In Lubbock.
And
we got a chance to talk to Lieutenant Davis. And I said, Lieutenant Davis, do you know who this is? He said, no. He says, Tony Romero, I was your radio man there for a while. And he said, I don't know if you remember me, but he acted like, he said, I remember you going to the hospital at Camp Swab and giving me a plaque before I went to Japan. And that's the last time I seen him.
You have it, don't you, the plaque?
Sir?
You have the plaque, don't you?
Yes, sir. I still got it, yeah.
What does it say?
Yeah. It says Corporal Tony Romero, I think, and Alpha Company 19, 3rd Marine Division.
Well, you feel like talking about February 22nd, 1969?
Yes, sir. Because of the fact that we were a mortar unit, and the way that jungle was, when we got hit, we were between second and third platoon, I think, and after they got the firing started, second platoon moved up in ahead of, third platoon moved up ahead of us, you know, and because of the overcast and the jungle and stuff there, there wasn't much that we could do. But all we did was carry the wounded and the dead, you know, from the front to the rear, you know.
How far were you from the front element?
We weren't very far. No, sir, I can't remember how far it was, but we weren't because it was a hell of a night, you know, a morning. And we couldn't get air support because of the fact that the way the jungle was, you know, they couldn't really, I don't think they could really tell where they would be dropping, you know, their moms and stuff.
When did this stuff start to happen? What time, do you remember?
I can't, it was already late. I'm thinking it was already late when we got, and it wound up, even in the morning, we were still pulling out guys, you know, early in the next morning, if I remember right, because it's all pretty foggy at this.
You guys,
but,
you guys needed water?
I'm thinking there was a few days before then that we were needing water, and they dropped some water because there was a helicopter coming in to bring us water, and it got fired on, and they let the water off of a parachute, and it drifted, and our team had to go in. And I don't remember. I think me and Oscar were on that team that went in and got the water and brought it back. But there was days, in the summertime that we were without water for 4 or 5 days, you know, because we couldn't get resupplied. You know, we'd chop banana trees and drink the sap from the banana trees. And in the winter time, I mean, during the monsoon season, a lot of times it was raining so bad and the fog was so bad that we couldn't get food, you know. And we'd go, you know, 4 or 5 days without food, you know. And all we do is talk about food. We couldn't have any, but we would say when we go back to the rear, as soon as we get food, we're gonna eat everything we can find. And in the summertime, we'd say as soon as we get water, I'm gonna drown myself in water, you know. And we would, you know, we would drink and remember, you know, and like here. Like here in town now, I save water, I save food, I guess it's because of a van, you know, being without it, you know, you get to the point to where you save, you know, you want to save and not use and not throw away. Whenever I take my grandkids to eat, I say, you better eat everything you get, you know.
Did you got dehydrated then out there in the jungle?
Oh, I've seen guys that would have, what do you call it, the covul, would go into,
convulsions?
Yeah, and get all hysterical and crazy with, dehydration, you know, and we would hold them down and give them what we had, you know, and there was guys getting malaria pretty regular and sick and it was pretty bad, you know, because we were always sick and tired and sleepy and just wore out, you know, completely wore out, you know.
Well, so you were in back of the lead element, and you guys were pinned down that evening.
Yeah, we couldn't fire because, like I said, I was with the mortar squad, you know, and that was, we were hell useless in that battle, you know. But what we did was and the dead, try to move them back and get them where they'd be safe, you know, because as far as the mortar squad that we had, we really couldn't do anything in that terrain.
How long did the firefight last?
It seemed like forever. No, I can't remember offhand, but we were there, you know, we got ambushed, and it seemed like, I can't remember what, 2-9 or 3-9 came in to, I think they came in to help us, but I can't remember, it was a lifetime, seemed like, that we were there.
Now, did you see Lee that day?
Yes, sir.
Tell me when that was and tell me about it.
Well, I just remember him taking his unit, you know. I remember him with his unit. And I think he was they were ahead of us. I think he was with the second platoon right in front of us, because we were between second and third platoon as we were going in that the canyon, the valley there, that Ashdown Valley.
So was this after the mortar hit the command group?
That was about the same time.
Did you see any of the people in the command group after the mortar?
We pulled a lot of them guys out, you know. In fact, the only one that I remember by name that we pulled out after he was dead was who was the other one that got killed?
Chrisman?
Christian, yeah.
Chrisman.
Lieutenant Christian, because Lieutenant Christian was short. He was like 5'6". And he was like 6, like 5'6" and 5'6" wide. I mean, this guy was—he weighed probably 300 pounds.
Really?
You know, he was. I mean, he was. He looked like a bull. You know, and I remember because he was heavy to carry.
Wow.
He was. We had. He was what do you call it, a poncho liner.
Uh-huh.
We had him wrapped. We had him in a poncho liner, moving him out to the rear. And it was the terrain was real bad. And I think it was wet. Yeah, it was wet and rainy, I think, or foggy and we were carrying. I remember him because I've never carried anything so heavy in my life. I think there was four of us. We were slipping and sliding and falling and trying to get them down to where they could air vac them, and then bringing all the moving the other guys that were wounded real bad. I remember when Lieutenant Fox's radio man, what was his name? He was up there in Lubbock. Decker?
Decker, yeah.
Decker was when he got hit, yeah. Yeah, he had a big old chunk of shrapnel in his arm. A big old chunk. It was still in his arm when we pulled him back, trying to get him to the medics.
Was he in a lot of pain?
He was in a lot of pain, yeah.
Bleeding badly?
I think most of it was shock, you know. Shock. He was in shock. And he had that big old slab of shrapnel in his arm.
Now, Tony, if you would kind of help me picture in my mind the where the mortar came in, the command group. kind of what the terrain looked like? Did they have a table set up, or were they just out? Did they have a little camp? A
table? What do you mean?
Well, not table, but kind of a place where they could get cover and everything.
Who would give cover?
Well, the command group. Kind of tell me about the terrain and the situation.
The terrain was a jungle type terrain, if I remember right. But we were in a valley type deal where we got ambushed, where the lead company got ambushed, and I think we were told that there was like 3,000 troops that we got hit that day. Almost everybody got wounded that day except for me and a few other guys, you know. There was a lot of wounded, a lot of dead.
Well, who else did you carry?
I remember the lieutenant that I remember, and I remember Decker because I remember I can still see him with that shrapnel on his arm, you know, and I can't remember names, you know, as far as who the other guys were because there was, you know, we were always Alpha Company had between 95 and 110 men strong at all times, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of guys, you know. But we pulled back because we were the ones in the rear, you know, making the because we couldn't really, our mortars couldn't do anything with all that overcover, what do you call it?
Canopy.
Canopy. There wasn't much we couldn't use our mortars, you know. There was another right before that, we were in another battle before that where another lieutenant that was in charge of Whitman's platoon told me, them guys are getting hit up there. I want you to sit up and fire. And I says, and I was the section leader, and I says, we can't fire, you know. He says, I order you to fire, you know. I said, I'm not going to obey your order because we can't fire because of the overhead, you know, the canopy. And he couldn't figure that out, you know. And he said that he was going to get me court-martialed, you know. And after that incident, he took me up in front of Captain Fox, you know, and Captain Fox jumped all over his ass.
I imagine.
Oh, shit, he, you know, and he got hit. I can't remember his name anymore, but he got hit with friendly fire the next time we had a firefight. He got hit with friendly fire. He was a real smart officer, but he needed to be at a base someplace behind a desk and not out as a combat leader, you know. I can't remember his name, but he lost a leg, and I knew the guy that blew it off. Guy from Los Angeles, California, and fired him, you know, fired on him. And because he wasn't liked and didn't know and wasn't, shouldn't have been out there with us, you know. I mean, I'm sure you've heard of things like that happening
in
combat,
sir.
You know?
Yes.
And this guy, I mean, you could ask him something and you couldn't understand what he was saying because he didn't make no sense, you know? He couldn't speak our language, you know? He was highly educated and he should have been at the rear someplace working behind the desk. He shouldn't have never been up there with us or with any other unit as far as in combat. I think about him all the time, whatever happened to him, but I can't remember his name. But I don't remember he was with us for very long.
You remember when the last time you saw Lee?
It was probably that day, the 21st, or the 22nd, or it had to be right there, you know, because we were always, my unit was always, 4th Platoon was always between and back of 2nd Platoon, and 3rd Platoon was usually in back of us.
Well, can you tell me a little bit more about the when you guys were carrying the dead and wounded up the hill?
It was like... I don't know. I'm not very good with words. It was a hell of a night. You know, it was just like complete. I don't know, something like 9/11, I guess. You know, it was just crazy And we couldn't believe it, you know. It was. We've seen fights. We've seen guys get hit, but it was like a nightmare. It was hard to believe, but we were acting on instinct, you know. Mm-hmm. We knew what we had to do, and that's what we did, you know. And I think everybody was doing the same thing, you know. You know, you look at a guy and you could, he had that 1,000 miles stare in his eye, you know, just like freaked out, you know. But I don't think nobody expected that many troops to be in that valley.
Hey, Tony, can you tell me just, I know that you probably remember looking across that valley. Can you describe it for me? I mean, I know it's jungle. I know it's lots of dense trees, and it was very, very foggy and rainy. But can you kind of give me a left to right view of it?
Oh, I don't know. We wouldn't have known. I wouldn't have known it was a valley till we got in it, you know. Mm-hmm. Till we were in it, and I don't know how to explain it. Have you talked with Oscar?
Well, I'm going to.
Mm-hmm.
You're the first one.
Yeah.
The only other one I talked to was Cosner.
Who?
Lenny Cosner.
I remember the name, I think. Yeah. Another person that you could talk to would be, I can't remember if he was there, if he had rotated before, but John Nolan.
Okay.
I got his number. I'm pretty sure he was there. I can't remember, but I'm sure he was still there on February 22nd.
Well, I'd like to get his number. I don't have his number. I don't
know. Yeah, yeah. Let me get it for you.
Thank you.
It's right here.
You know what? It wasn't Lenny Cosner that I talked to, but Lenny Cosner was he was a friend. I think he was a foxhole buddy of Frank Stopiello.
Yeah, Frank.
You remember Frank?
I remember Frank. Yeah. Yeah.
And Frank.
He got killed the 22nd one, didn't he?
Frank? No, Frank is was wounded. He's paralyzed.
Oh, so he was wounded. Yeah.
He actually was Heron, Lieutenant Heron stopped and asked the two of them.
He was his what?
Lieutenant Heron stopped and asked the two of them during the firefight for to be his radio man.
Oh yeah.
And it was Frank who volunteered.
Oh yeah.
Because Lenny was just getting ready to go back and he had family at the house, so he just kind of froze in his tracks, and Frank said, "I'll go with you." And
yeah,
when they moved in up the gut,
yeah,
that's when the machine gun caught Frank.
And there was only how many survived that when Lieutenant Herring, I can't remember if it was three or four guys or something like that, or two guys.
Yes, sir.
And I think there was two or three guys that only survived.
I wish I could tell you right now, Tony, but right at this point, I'm not
really
real keen on the number.
Yeah.
But I'm going to be talking to David Byerline, Pete Giacchetta, Oscar, James Davis. I'm going to talk to George Malone, Ted Decker, Charles Hudson, and there are a number of others here.
Yeah. John, you got John Nolan's number, right? Yeah, I just gave it to you. Yeah.
It was, Tony, it was Terry Presgrove that I interviewed, the first person that was I interviewed him. And he's in Oklahoma.
Uh-huh.
Did you remember Terry?
I can't remember. We didn't go by first names much, you know?
Right.
Last names that I remember, Prescott seems like it is. I remember it, but I'm not too sure. What platoon was he with?
I don't have my notes here in front of me, but
yeah.
I think that he was with the. I want to say he was with the third.
Third platoon, yeah.
But he was knocked unconscious by a mortar blast, and it was soon after that that Heron moved up to him and asked for his dressing, and he had already used that on his buddy.
Yeah.
So and then that's the last time that Terry saw Lieutenant Heron.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah, like I say, third platoon moved ahead of us. And we stayed right at the rear, you know, because we couldn't do much in that terrain.
Did you? I guess you worked all through the night carrying wounded.
Yes, sir. We carried. Yeah. That morning. Yeah.
You must have been exhausted.
But the only one that I really remember, like I said, was
Christman.
I remember Christian Yahweh because he was heavy, and it was the trail that we had was pretty bad, and I think we dropped him once or twice, but I don't think he felt it.
Right.
And I remember we carried. Decker. What's his first name?
Ted.
Ted, yeah.
Tony, who was helping you carry?
I can't even remember who it was. There was four of us, I think,
okay.
Four or five of us that carried the lieutenant, and we're just going back and forth, you know.
Did you see any of your buddies when you got to the top of that hill?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah. Well, we were together every day. You know.
Yeah.
You know.
Can you tell me a little bit about that? How you felt when you got up there on top of that hill?
Completely freaked out. You know. Not. I guess. Till we went back to the rear, we, you know, it didn't hit you till later, you know, that what we had just went through, just like any other firefight, you know, it wouldn't hit you till after, you know, because we were like robots, you know, while we were in combat. And then after it was over, then you were freaked out, or you know, it would hit you later, you know, the emotion and everything would just hit you after it was all over.
How many dead did you see that day?
I can't remember how many. You know, they were, but there was a lot of dead and a lot of wounded.
You remember seeing Lieutenant Heron?
I can't remember if I seen him after he had died. I don't. I might have been one of the guys that carried him back. I can't, because they were on poncho liners, you know, and we had them lifted on poncho liners, and some guys didn't have poncho liners. We carried them, you know, but I remember the lieutenant, that we had him on a poncho liner, because I'm thinking there was four, five, six guys carried him, because he was so damn big and heavy.
What color were the liners?
Sir?
What color were the poncho liners?
Oh, they're green.
So, can you tell me about the events after that? I mean, the morning came, did you guys get rest? And then when were the dead and wounded choppered out? And then what did you do that next day?
I think we had another operation right after that. I think that was when, remember I was telling you when I got that in March?
Yes, sir.
When I got that medal for that episode in March, the dead that were at the bottom of that that trail where they met up with them with our team that was coming in to change over, they had maps and stuff on them with them. Somebody said that there were NVA pay officers or some kind of officers or stuff from the NVA Army, and they had maps and stuff, and we went ahead and moved and went and crossed into the ocean. We went into Laos,
yes.
And we followed the maps. We went into Laos and captured capture one of the biggest ammunition catches of the war. You know, I got pictures of that.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Well, we went, like I said, we weren't supposed to go into Laos, but we went in. We went in and found this catch of ammunition and machine guns and rifles and chi-coms and all kinds of damn weapons. And we went through them, stockpiled a bunch of stuff, and Lieutenant Fox said, each one of you can keep one of them rifles, a brand new rifle, red Chinese rifle. It was done, there were SKSs. They wouldn't let us bring back full machine guns, but he said we could bring back an SKS, which was a semi-automatic rifle, and we all got one to bring back. We had a humpback, back into Vietnam, where the helicopters picked us up and took us back to the rock pile. And on the way on the humpback to Vietnam, one of my buddies, because the terrain was pretty bad, it was wet and real bad terrain, and he got his rifle and he threw it away. He says, I'm not gonna carry this damn thing, you know. You know, we were all loaded up with a lot of gear. So he throws his away, and I went and picked it up and strapped it on my back. I had one going one way and one the other. I look like Pancho Villa. We're all loaded up with two rifles and shit.
Did you keep them both?
Well, let me tell you. We went back to the rear, and we were going to be there for three or four days. And I asked Lieutenant Captain Fox if I could. We were at Quang Tri, and I asked Lieutenant Fox if I could jump on the chopper and go to Dang Ha. Dang Ha was like 8 miles down the road, another base. And I had a buddy that was a captain in the army there at Quang Tri at Dang Ha. And he went and seen me a couple of times. I'd ride him and let him know where we were at and stuff, what hill and stuff. And he was, if they were running operations close by there, well, he would go and see me. He was one of my boxing coaches here in town, here in Clovis. His name was Jerry Wright. He was a captain. He was in charge of a duster unit. You know what a duster is?
I'm not sure.
It's like a tank, but it's got I think four guns on it, and they fire 40 or 60 millimeter rounds on it. Like a tank, but it's a little smaller, you know, and it's got a bunch of guns on it, like machine guns on it.
Right.
But it's a bigger shell. I think it's a 40 millimeter. Anyway, Jerry was in the Army Reserve, and his unit got activated about the same time that I was in Vietnam. And he was one of my boxing coaches here in town.
Wow.
So he went to see me up one time. In fact, I introduced him to Captain Fox when he was up there. He would go up there and take us water and beer and food and stuff, you know. So anyway, I got one of them rifles, I had that extra rifle, you know, and I says, I'm going to take it and give it to Jerry, you know. So when we got back across the into Vietnam and we got picked up by helicopters, took us back to the rock pile, and I asked Captain Fox, I says, could I take off and go to Dong Hao, and I want to give this rifle to Captain Wright. And he said, well, be back in a couple of days, you know. So there was a convoy going up there. I think it was about, I can't remember if it was 8, 6, 8, 10 miles. It wasn't very far, but there was a convoy going up there. So I jumped on the jeep, gave me a ride, and we were out about maybe a mile, and the truck in front of the jeep hit some mine on the highway and blew it up, you know. So we got out and put a security out, you know, and they tried to pull that truck out of the way with another truck and get it out the road, and it hit another mine. So, and they swept the mine, the roads in the mornings, you know. But hell, as soon as they sweep them, and right after they sweep them, they remind them again, you know. Mm-hmm. And so they said, we got to call in a sweeping team to come and sweep this road again. So they turned the convoy around, and I went back to the airfield there, to the landing zone, and jumped on a helicopter going to Dong Ha. And I landed in Dong Ha and started looking for Jerry's unit there, and found it, and he was there. And I said, God damn, I said, I'd like to got killed coming up here to see you and bring you this damn rifle. So I gave him the rifle, and I stayed there that night, and left the next day, went back to Wang Tree the next day, and them guys treated me great there at the Army. I slept in the officers' tents and ate in their mess halls and shit, and it was pretty neat. I felt 10 foot tall, man, because you know he treated me good, you know. And I see Jerry lives in El Paso, but he comes to Clovis a lot, and I still see him. But anyway, I gave him that rifle, and he never had papers made for it. So when he got hit, he lost it, you know. He couldn't, when he got medevac, he couldn't bring it back to the States.
Oh.
And what happened to me is, when we went to Okinawa, and they took the rifles that they, you know, back with us, you know, back to Okinawa, and then when I got malaria in Okinawa, that I was going to be transported to Japan, I wrote on a piece of paper to a buddy of mine from Long Beach, California. His name was Jim Decker, a good buddy of mine from Long Beach. I gave him the serial number and permission to bring it back to the States for me, because I figured I wouldn't see him, you know, because he was going to come back to the country. And I was going to Japan to the hospital. Mm-hmm. So anyway, after I go through all the hospitals and finally get out of the Marine Corps December 5th, when I went 6 or 7 months later, when I finally went to California to box for professional, I went straight to Long Beach, and Jim gave me my rifle.
Well, how about
Yeah. And the first time that I came back to New Mexico from California to visit when I was boxing in California, I had my boxing career, I had 21 wins and 8 losses when I finally retired from professional boxing. And I was on television in California and fought on cards with George Foreman. I fought on a card with George Foreman and a few other world champions at that time and had a good career. But anyway, when I was coming, the first time that I came back to New Mexico from California, I brought my rifle with me. And I walked in to the LAX, the airport in Los Angeles. I walked in with that rifle, and about 3 or 4 security people jumped me there, stopped me, you know, wondering what the hell I was doing carrying a rifle in an airport, you know.
Communist rifle
to boot. Sure.
A communist rifle to boot.
Yeah, and I showed them the paperwork that I had from the government, you know, and they went ahead and put it in a compartment there in the airplane. And when I got to Albuquerque, they gave it to me, you know, and I brought it back to Clovis and gave it to my oldest brother. Mm. And after we made, I think it was a Chinese rifle. Anyway, after we made, we started having relations with the Red Chinese. I was able to get shells for it, and I fired it a few times, you know, and I didn't want nothing to do with it. I gave it to my brother, and he still has it, I think. Yeah, but it was brand new. It was wrapped up in cosmoline cloth, and... you know, all them, we found tons and tons of ammunition and rifles and machine guns and
Your company couldn't take all of that out of there, did they, or did they?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No, what we did was we stockpiled all that stuff, and when we left Laos, they sent in an airstrike and blew all that crap up. And what I heard the last time was our battalion commander was Colonel Smith in Vietnam. And because of the fact that Laos was a neutral country, there was some problems with us running an operation in Laos because we weren't supposed to be in Laos. So what I heard was that they punished Colonel Smith for giving us orders to go into Laos. So what they did was relieve him of his command in Vietnam, send him back to the States, and made him a general just to keep peace with the Laotian government. They got rid of him as a punishment, you know. But they turned around and made him a general, I heard. Am I making any sense?
Yes, sir, you are.
Yeah.
I appreciate your time.
Yeah, I hadn't gone into... I know it's hard to understand me, and because I'll jump from one thing to another, but...
No, that's the way you remember it. And that's,
yeah, well, I think of this stuff in like frames, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think of different mixed up in different frames, and if I was to write a book, it would take me a lifetime.
Well, I hope it doesn't take me a lifetime. But
I should have kept the diary. A lot of guys did that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I know Fox did, you know. They kept and most of the stuff, the communication that he did with his superiors, you know, it's all on file, you know.
That's right. But you had a little bit of interaction, sounds like, with Colonel Fox.
I liked Colonel Fox. But I admired Colonel Fox as a leader in Vietnam because I trusted him, and I had a lot of respect for the way he handled himself. You know, we were talking 3 or 4 days ago, the last time we talked, we were talking about Colonel Fox, and, you know, I told you how much I admired him and everything. But in Lubbock, I got the impression that I was thinking, I felt like he was taking part of, this was for Lieutenant Herring, you know.
Yes, sir.
And I kind of said like he was taking the stage, you know, from Lieutenant Herring. I felt kind of pissed off.
Did you?
You know. Yes, sir, I did. You know, I did. I felt like he was grabbing for something that wasn't his, you know. And I've met the colonel 2 or 3 different times. You know, I've met him or twice. I met him in Albuquerque like 10 or 12 or 15 years ago when during Veterans Day they had the what they call it, Medal of Honor Society.
Okay.
Up in Albuquerque. And there was all kinds of Medal of Honor winners. There was, I don't know, 50 or 60 Medal of Honor winners up there, you know. And I went up there just to see him, you know. And in fact, I marched in that parade with our American Legion unit here in town. I was an officer with the American Legion, and we went up there to march, and I was hoping to see him. And I got a chance to meet him and his wife, you know. But seemed like it was all about the Medal of Honor in Albuquerque, you know.
Right.
But in Lubbock, it was still about his Medal of Honor and not honoring, maybe I'm wrong, you know, but I felt like, man, this isn't your, you're not the star here, you know, this is for Lieutenant Herring and not you, you know. And I don't know, maybe it was just me, you know, I don't feel the same way as I did before Lubbock, you know. I thought it was all about, and he was talking about his book, you know, we talked for a while, and he says, why don't you get this book, and, you know, the book about him, you know, and I wasn't impressed, you know.
Did you tell him, Colonel, I was there, I remember?
Yeah. We talked for a little bit, but I wasn't impressed because it wasn't for him, it was for Lieutenant Herring, you know. And I even told Oscar, because me and Oscar, we were up there and talked about it. A few years ago, I was up in Arizona and Phoenix. We were going. I was taking a pro fighter to fight in one of my pros to fight and we fought in Phoenix. So I called Oscar and I hadn't seen him since Vietnam. And I called him and he met us at the airport, you know, and we went up to the weigh-ins and he went to the fights that night and we spent some time together and a couple of different times when I flew into the Phoenix, I've called him up, you know. But we haven't talked much since Lubbock. We've talked, I ain't talked to Oscar now in over a year, I guess. And I think he knows. I told him that I was upset with the Lubbock thing with Colonel Fox. I says it wasn't his show, you know. Maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me that he was pushing himself, you know what I mean?
Well,
put him in the spotlight.
Yeah. Well, you told me, you know, that Lieutenant Heron was a different kind of man in the field than Colonel Fox was. People really.
Oh yeah.
Everybody liked.
Oh
him.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Because you know you couldn't bush. You know you couldn't talk to Colonel Fox like we're talking now. You know,
mm-hmm.
He was always serious and in charge and the boss. You know,
mm-hmm.
And like I said before, I had a lot of respect for him in Vietnam. You know, if he'd tell me you can walk through fire, I would walk through fire. You know what I mean?
You bet.
But after we came back, and especially in Lubbock, I wasn't impressed with him.
How did
and
you?
Maybe it was just me. I don't know. But, and I even came home and told Rose that, you know, I said, man, I can't believe this was special for Lieutenant Heron, and it seemed like Fox just took the show over. But I don't know how you feel, but.
Well, I was just in awe that day because.
You were what?
I was in awe of what was going on. I mean, I just was just so, you know. I remember being pretty emotional, and
uh-huh.
Because you know I had met David Nelson, his friend, and
yeah,
and we had seen all of this come together. We helped David put together,
yes, sir.
The scholarship.
Put it together, yes,
yeah.
Sir. Yeah, and that was great. Way to you guys to do something like that. You know,
well,
in fact, the other day I was just reading the pamphlet with his picture on it.
Yeah,
I got it out the other night and I was looking at it and kind of. Because I knew you'd be asking me stuff about him, and I just wanted to look at his picture and kind of remember stuff, you know.
Remember it.
Yeah.
How did you hear about the ceremony?
I think through Oscar.
Okay.
Yeah, Oscar's the one that told me about it. And then I think he sent my name in or something,
okay.
In my address. Oops, I'm sorry.
No problem, I'm here. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I'm so glad that I spoke to you that day.
Yeah.
Because I knew you were a one-niner, I mean, when you walked into the room.
Uh-huh.
But you didn't come in there with any kind of error or to, you know, you were contrite and very reverent.
Well, it wasn't. You know, I wasn't the center of attraction there. You know, I was proud to be there, and I was glad I was invited and able to go. You know, I felt good when I heard about what you guys were doing. You know, and I thought that's great because like I said, I talked with them. I don't know how many times, you know, but I liked him, and then dying the way he did, you know, that was the ultimate sacrifice that a great man makes, you know.
Yes. you remember, you know, you were looking at his photograph, and you met his mother, did you not?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I talked to his mom, yeah.
Did you see the resemblance in their
eyes?
Yes,
sir. Yeah.
She
still lives there in Lubbock, huh?
Oh, you bet. She's a good friend of mine now.
Yeah.
And I talk to her almost every week.
Do you?
She's a firecracker, though. She
is she?
She
good.
She doesn't take any jack off of anybody.
Is that right?
I mean, she's really tough-minded. And
that's good,
she speaks her mind. And,
that's good, yeah.
And, that's the first thing.
Are they a farming family or no?
No, sir, they're, Roy Heron, Lee's dad, was a filling station. He owned a filling station here.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Station. And,
yeah.
He worked at Sears, retired at Sears.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. They're just a working class family. And of course, Jane, Lee's sister.
Yeah.
Lives.
I met her too. Yeah.
Yeah. She's a teacher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Time flies, man. Yeah. You know, I think of little, different times and different firefights and stuff. Every day, you know, I think about the crap that we went through, you know, different guys. And don't think that it's been over 30 years.
Yes, that is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Did you have, can you tell me about any of the discussions that you had with the team?
With who?
With your fellow Marines during the ceremony or after the ceremony?
Oh, we just talked about different guys and stuff, you know. I told them about, you know, John, you know, that I communicate with Billy Honeycutt in Oklahoma, you know, and Jim Decker. We had two Deckers. The radio man, what did you say his name was?
Ted.
Ted Decker, and then we had a buddy of mine with mortars. His name was Jim Decker. He was from Long Beach, California, and no relation. And we just kind of talked about guys that, you know, that we remembered, you know.
Didn't you go out to eat with the guys afterwards?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think I went with them. I think I jumped in my truck and came back home. I just, you know, the Fox thing, I just didn't feel like, I don't know. I think I'm the only one that felt like that. I don't, you know, Oscar was praising him and Ted and everybody, you know. I just.
You knew, Tony, that Fox put Lee in for the Medal of Honor.
And what?
Did you know that he put Lee in for the Medal of
Honor? And I knew that you need so many witnesses to.
Yes, sir.
To. Yeah, I know he did. Yeah, yes, sir. And he's the one that put me in for my medal.
Yep.
You know. Yeah.
I understand, though, how you feel.
Yeah.
I can see that. But, yeah. You know, Lord willing, this book on Leroy is going to bring honor to his name and to his
family. I'm sure it will. Yes, sir.
To his family.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
And I am very, very happy that you're a part of that, Tony.
Well, I hope that I helped you, you know.
Well, we'll probably have more discussions together, and sometime I'd like to make it up to Clovis and visit.
Okay.
With you.
Yeah.
Go out and see the horses or whatever. Maybe you can.
That'd be great. Yeah.
But it's 11 o'clock, and it's probably time to go tuck the kids in bed. But
yeah. Yeah, Rose done went to sleep.
Well, I if you have anything else to say or any recollections, I'd love to hear.
I'll write stuff down and try to remember and write stuff down and let you know. Yeah.
Still interested in that person you're trying to remember earlier?
Oh man.
If you think about him.
Wait, give me a second. Let me get my see if I got my book here, let me see if I can find it here at the closet. What do you call it? When we graduated from boot camp, the picture, the book, the...
Oh, the album?
Album, yeah. Let me see if it's here someplace. Yeah, here it is. And I'll give you his name right quick. You might know him. I don't know if he still lives there in Lubbock or not. And I can always, I'm pretty good at remembering names and stuff.
You are.
But this guy, I can't remember. It is up the right one.
While you're looking, let me ask you a question. Do you remember visiting with Lee at Quariette?
Oh, man. I can't actually say that I do remember.
Guys,
I don't remember, no, sir.
Yeah, when you were...
He was there. I'm sure he was. Because I think we went twice, I think. Maybe we might have been there three times. But I'm thinking, I know we went twice. Let me see. I can't find this page that I'm looking for.
Now, I know you didn't talk to those same stewardesses when you got back on that flight and it said, we'll see you a year later.
No, because, we went on ship. We left Vietnam. We left on ship to Okinawa, and then from there I went aerovac and a C-130 to Japan, and then back to California on a C-130, and back to I got discharged out of Corpus Christi. I'm going through pages here and I can't find it.
You know, every once in a while those guys get together. I mean, they had a reunion in Las
Vegas
a year or two ago.
Yeah, most of the time it's up in the East Coast someplace or California or something, you know. And okay, we're almost here.
Great.
I'll find it. I can't remember his name, but I'll look at his picture. Mayberry. Ronnie L. Mayberry.
Ron Mayberry.
Ronnie L. Mayberry. Yeah. Lubbock, Texas.
He's from Lubbock.
So one different.
Let me look at my dog tag.
John Mayberry. Hey, Tony?
Sir?
Was Ron Mayberry a coach? Was he a basketball coach by chance?
I don't. The last time that I seen him, he was 18, 19 years old.
Right.
You know,
of course,
in
yeah.
boot camp. You know.
Well, we had a coach at South Plains College, Community College.
Uh-huh.
Ron. And that may be the same guy.
It might be. Because all I know is he was from Lubbock, and his